Hi, and welcome to the new year and to a new VFX show. I'm Mike Seymour, and I'm joined on the line by two long-time co-hosts, starting with David. David, how are you?
I'm quite well. How about yourself?
Good, sir. We've just established that LA is unseasonably cold, but not as cold as presumably it is where Mark is joining us from San Francisco.
400 miles north, yeah. It is colder here. At least 10 degrees colder.
Yes, yes.
And got you beat, David.
We were looking forward to also having John Flowers join us, but John's gone AWOL. Apparently, he's been derailed by the unseasonably cold weather. So if he joins us later, that would be great. Otherwise, we're going to have a chat this week about the film The Curious Case of Benjamin Button. And I'm going to go and lead off the charge because I want to get my, biased on the out in public early on. I think it's going to win the Oscar for best visual effects this year.
I agree.
Oh, okay, so if it doesn't,
it's a sham.
So what do you think, Will? Yes. David, what do you think?
I think, well, the film itself is brilliant, and I think the visual effects are stunning. Easily the best visual effects I've seen since Gollum, maybe even since Jurassic Park. I haven't had visual effects affect me on such a visceral level as these did.
I must admit, for me, it had two hallmarks of something that I hadn't had for a fair while. The first one was, I wonder how they did that. I just started pondering, like, really, how did they do that? And then the second thing I found myself wondering is at what point we were moving from digital to non-digital, two things that normally I don't sort of find myself doing in the cinema. And we have a story on it on fxguide.com, but it's now sort of fairly well known that, in fact, about the first 52 minutes of the film didn't have Brad Pitt live. He'd had Brad sort of performance captured and then digitally head inserted into the film. And so this is, I think, one of the most remarkable aspects is that we could watch a film that's emotional, dramatic, and one of the lead characters for a significant proportion of the film he's actually got a computer-generated head, and that didn't put everybody off and cause everybody to say that it's a, or that it isn't, like a sort of sci-fi thing where that character is completely non-human and we wouldn't care anyway. So let's start with a discussion of the film before we get to the visual effects. And Mark, what's your sort of assessment of the film? Was it too long for you, or was it all right?
It was long, and I have to admit, this part of the discussion, it's going to come off sounding, maybe not quite as I intended, but I thought it is probably the most fantastic film I've seen that I really had the thought in the middle, why did they make this film? So at the same time as I thought it was amazing, I felt oddly disconnected from the story. Be that as it may, and I think we can maybe get into that a little bit more because it does touch a little bit on the choice of topic. But anyway, so, I mean, that was my impression, just honest assessment while I was watching it. It was long, but, pretty grand. Definitely, like any good Fincher film, it had plenty of nice tidbits to keep you going, though, like things that you were glad you'd seen along the way.
Yeah. Well, what did you think, David, before we get into the visual effects, just in terms of storyline? I know that you write a lot.
Well, it was not too long. It could have been longer and I would not have minded. As of this recording, I've actually seen the film four times. I've seen it three times in the theater. I've seen it three times in the theater and once on a screener. It's a film that affected me very profoundly on a couple of different levels. And I'm actually going to compare it to two movies, which I think, one, a lot of people have been comparing it to, and the second, no one has.
So let me guess the first one with Mark's help. So I'm going to guess the first one you're going to say is Forrest Gump?
Yes, absolutely. It's Forrest Gump.
And Mark, do you want to take a second guess at what his other film will be?
You pick the low-hanging fruit. I'm going to say not Batman Returns.
Okay, so what is it? What did it remind you of, David?
Armageddon.
And what?
I realized when I was like thinking about this that people are going to be like, "What the hell
sorry.
Is he thinking?"
You actually serious?
I'm perfectly serious because
we're talking Bruce Willis, Big Rock from Space, stupid film.
Yes,
this is going to be good.
Okay, I'm strapping down for this one.
Well, here's okay. The thing: is Armageddon is an incredibly insipid, stupid film.
Yes,
and I don't think anyone will argue that. But every single time I watch that movie, by the end of that movie, I'm in tears, going, "Oh my God, Bruce Willis is dying, so that Ben Affleck doesn't have to." It hits you on this like purely emotional level, and. I think that this film
all the films that you were going to name, and I'm sorry, my friend, but I just got to tell you, dude, that was not one that I was expecting. I mean,
that's awesome. That is just awesome.
Because I think Benjamin Button does some similar things, because especially has a lot of similarities with Forrest Gump. The problem with this movie, to a lot of people, is they're bored. And the reason I think they're bored is our hero, I'm putting air quotes around that, doesn't do anything in this movie.
Yeah, he's very reactionary to the environment that he's in.
A lot of stuff happens to him, but he doesn't really incite anything to happen.
Which would have given me Forrest Gump, but you've got to walk me a little further before I'm going to get there on Armageddon.
Right. So it'd be so easy to not care about... you know, the character of Benjamin Button. But just like it would be very easy to not care about Forrest Gump, but he's such a good and decent person. There's nothing he does that makes you not like him. And that all these things that happen to him, if you've had something very similar happen in your life, it hits you on an emotional level that you don't have any conscious way of reacting to that or analyzing it. It just hits you on a purely emotional level.
I think you're absolutely right there. And I think, sorry to interrupt you, but I think also what you're almost saying, but I think I'm going to articulate it for you, is if you've actually lost someone close to you, if you've dealt with loss, then this starts to resonate, this film, this whole idea of loss and time passing. And if you haven't had that experience, if you're, you know, footloose and fancy free, then maybe, yeah, sure, it's not going to, you know, grab you by the collar and take you on a ride. But I'm still there on Forrest Gump. That's still true. That good-natured view of the world, or somebody who has a quiet about them, who isn't hurrying through life. But I still need you to walk me the rest of the way on Armageddon.
What I'm saying is that in Armageddon, it's an incredibly stupid film. And you are given absolutely no reason to care about any of the characters in that movie. Yet at the end of the movie, because they've hit every emotional button, no pun intended, perfectly, you wind up having a purely visceral reaction to what's happening. And you emote, whether you want to or not. I mean, I am always sad at the end of Armageddon, not only because that movie was made, but because of, you know, the whole sacrifice scene. It hits you, and there's nothing you can do about it, at least nothing I can do about it. And I think, you know, Button, the movie Benjamin Button, is... really, really, really important for people. Anyone who's the age 28 to 40 to see. Because you're at that age where you're not a kid anymore, by any means. But you're now gaining the wisdom to see how you've squandered that youth that you had while you're still close enough to really feel it. And... It's such an emotional, powerful film. Yes, if you've lost anybody in your life, which I lost somebody very close to me a couple of years ago, and that hit me during the movie and all that. But you know, I made a Twitter post recently saying that, like, when my parents left for the holidays, it was very poignant because my parents are getting to the age when I say goodbye to them, I might really be saying goodbye to them. And
yeah, no, I agree with you. And in fact, I did lose a father not long ago. And I think anyone that's faced loss, that's a sort of an undercurrent, a subtext of the film. And Mark, have you suffered a loss close to you? Do you find that that resonates with you at all, or is it just something that's only affecting David and I?
Well, I have to admit, now I feel the litmus test is on me a little bit here, because I was the one who was not so affected by this film. And, you know, I assume by the loss, the one that resonates is actually the mother-daughter relationship. Is that right? Or is it actually...
No, I think it's just the idea of the... For me, anyway, and I don't want to go too much into being, you know, film critic of the week. Certainly, this isn't Oprah, but it just seems to me that the whole film has a resonance about the issue of time passing and people dying. And, of course, it's magnified by the fact that it's reversed, as it were.
Yeah, I mean, to me, it too much used, and, you know, you can grant me that this is just my personal thing, but it too much used a gimmick that... The odd thing is that I totally bought it visually and I loved the scenes of it, but I didn't empathize certainly with this character, which I think you guys are to some extent saying he's a difficult guy to empathize with. And I would agree with that. And I also, there were holes in the premise that bugged me and I couldn't really let go of them. And it seemed to speak to a kind of a superficial notion about aging that I just didn't buy. So, you know, that's
let's move past the metaphysical and and deep psychological, because as I say, good. I don't want to be Dr. Mike.
And yeah, let's talk about the visuals, because they're
splendid
and
cool,
there's plenty to talk about.
and in that extent, I guess we've got a couple of things that we need to discuss, and the most obvious by far is the young / very old Benjamin Button in the first part of the film, because that's probably the most striking. There's a bunch of stuff we can talk about, a bunch of stuff they're going to do, but that was the one that there was no hiding from. It was the start of the film. And I want to start you guys off by referring to the US popcorn ads, the effective mm-hmm. Colonel Sanders of the popcorn world.
Orville Redenbacher.
Mm-hmm, that was done in around, I'm going to say, a few years ago, a couple of years ago. And these were ads that I personally thought did not work. I thought that they were pretty much hideous. And now we discover that to a certain extent, these were used as sort of test beds for some of the work that they were doing. So can I get, say, David, your opinion to start with on those ads? Did you see them when they came out? Did you have an opinion at the time?
I did. I actually got to see them a little bit earlier than they were in public. And I knew at the time that they were, you know, kind of development work for Benjamin Button. And I thought that they had gotten all together in a car and driven directly into the uncanny valley and set up tents and decide to camp there for a while.
I mean, I couldn't agree with you more. I just did not in any way relate to that as a character other than as a weird CG thing.
It was creepy beyond belief.
It was like going to the waxworks and they moved.
Yeah, only not as realistic as the wax museum. It was really intensely creepy. But what they did is they apparently packed up all their stuff and drove out the uncanny valley before they made this movie, because I'm going to go out here on a limb and say, you know, when you commented earlier that you were watching the digital head saying, oh my God, how did they do this? I was watching it going, wow, that's Brad Pitt. I completely forgot I was watching a visual effect.
I agree.
And I would say that this is the first movie, the very first movie, that can honestly lay claim to saying that they have defeated the uncanny valley.
I mean, go on, Mark.
No, I mean, I have to say they got out of that valley in a very clever way. And, you know, I did want to kind of add, I think we may, although I imagine 99.9% of our listeners know what the uncanny valley is, it might be just worth redefining exactly what we're talking about. Shall I do that?
Absolutely.
Okay, so if you imagine a curve approaching reality, and at one end of it you've got stick figures and things, which actually we as humans oddly can actually perfectly well relate to, much better than we can as you get really close to the other end of the curve, as you approach actuality, there's a valley, if you can imagine, that that occurs. If you think of the recent stock market, you might be able to picture how this cliffs off. And in that valley, you just suddenly go from it being a good enough thing that you can project your own humanity onto, to something that is just too close while giving too many indications that it is not close at all. Like something in you just kicks in that sees everything that's wrong. And it's exactly what you guys were describing about Orville Redenbacher, where it just feels very creepy. And yeah, like something that shouldn't be alive has been brought to life.
Literally, as you're approaching digital realism, there's a void to be crossed. And in that void, because you're relatively close but not quite across the line, as you say, you actually, your brain starts kicking in with, hey, there's something wrong with that person, and you're repelled by them. Now, I think
It's not just digital effects, though. It's, I mean, the term was originally applied to robotics, and it can be applied to any kind of simulacrum of humanity. I think one of the best examples of it is in Total Recall, the exploding Arnold head, which I don't think anyone really buys as really being Arnold's head.
Come on, David, that's an awesome effect. Come on, man.
or the digital woman's mask at the customs line when he pops off the head.
Oh, that's the one I was talking about.
That's the one I was speaking of.
I think we're talking about the same one.
For a second, I thought you were talking about the eyes popping out of the head at the end.
No, I was talking about when the head opens up.
We're
and
such
he pulls
blokes.
It off,
we so know every effect in
Total the Arnold head that's underneath is obviously not Arnold's head. It's like a maquette or a puppet of some kind, and you now also have these kind of really, really creepy robots coming out of Japan for, customer service reps at CES, and I don't want to know what else other uses people have planned for them.
But leaving aside Japanese sex toys for a second, the fact is that what we're saying is, in this film, when we're watching him sitting on the patio wanting to go and play with the other children but actually having the body of a very old man, We're just buying him. Our brain isn't rejecting. We've crossed that point, and we've got to a point that we're empathetically feeling it was kind of sad that he can't go and run with the kids and not
see. Now, I have a slightly more complicated view of it than that.
Okay.
And you have to remember, I'm the guy who didn't totally buy that premise. So, in fact, to me, they got around the uncanny valley by choosing an uncanny premise. And so it's kind of like the Victor Victoria trick, where she gets everybody to buy that she's a man because she passes herself off as a count. And so everybody questions, is she really a count? So I was sitting there going, well, what would it be like
you
for
guys
this
are
old
coming
man
up with
to
really
be a little
good
boy?
Filmic analogies this week. Go on. I'm there. No, I've got that one. Yes.
Oh, good, good. So I'm sitting there going, well, what would it really be like for an 89-year-old man to be in the position of being a 6-year-old boy? And at that point, it's such a surreal premise, that I'm not, it's also extraordinarily well done. Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that they totally like cleverly just figured it out and got around it through a complete cheat. I'm just saying, I think that by choosing an uncanny premise, they pulled something off that might be difficult to do the other way around.
Okay, I'm sitting opposite you in the conference room, and we're having a chat in pre-production. And I would say back to you, well, that's all very well and good, but we're trying not to depict someone that's dead that no one knows. We're trying to depict somebody that everybody knows really, really well, Brad Pitt. Mm-hmm. And not only that, we're going to see him a few minutes later in the film. So if we got it wrong, they're going to be reminded what his head looks like in a few minutes' time. And so maybe the Victor Victoria angle buys him some slack, but actually doing such a well-known actor. I mean, I wouldn't have known what the popcorn guy was like if I'd not seen him.
Yeah. I mean, the thing about the Uncanny Valley being that you have to remember, you can be 98% there, and if you miss the other 2%, you've totally lost everybody. In this case, I think, if they were off at all, that they got the rest of the way there just by this premise. I think that's all I'm really saying.
Yeah, but there's a couple things that did bother me on my first viewing that when I thought about them, I realized what they did. Like, they made his head slightly larger because a kid's head is slightly larger, whereas an old person's head is not necessarily that. One of the conceits that they did do, which I thought was a little bit weird, is a lot of the things that are associated with old age are due to the fact of you being on the Earth for so long and, you know, gravity having its effect on you. And, you know, like, you know, his voice wouldn't be like, 7, but I look a lot older. You know, if he hadn't been speaking with his voice box for 80 years.
You know, if you're going to make him go old in reverse,
you've got to be old. They made that decision very early on. And, you know, at the end of the film, when he gets younger, they also made him get smaller. I was worried they were going to do... There's a hilarious website called manbabies.com, which, you know, where they take the head of an infant and the head of the father and they swap them. And it's absolutely hilarious. But, you know, I was worried they were going to have this, you know, 6'2" infant at the end. And I'm glad they didn't. You know, they made some conceits for storytelling. It reminded me a lot of, oh my God, I'm blanking on the name of it, the Tim Burton movie. Came out a couple years ago when it was like the carnival with the twins. Helena Bonham Carter was in
Sleepy
it, of course.
Sleepy Hollow.
What? No.
Sleepy Hollow?
Not Sleepy Hollow. It had Obi-Wan Kenobi in it. Damn it. You know, it had a lot of that kind of fairy tale... A Big Fish. That was the name of the movie. It had a lot of that fairy tale feel to it that, like just in its style and how it was made, that you kind of accepted these kind of just conceits of storytelling that they threw at you and said, yeah, he's old now and he's small and he's young now and he's small again. Just go with it. Okay. I kind of like that, but,
I just want to jump in and say we've been saying the word they quite a bit. Let me just define they. We've obviously discussed the film is directed by David Fincher. The visual effects supervisor was Eric Barber, and the facility that we've been mainly hitting on the work of, in other words, the young / old Benjamin Button, is primarily Digital Domain, though there are some exceptional additional work done later in the film by companies like Hydraulics and Lola and stuff.
Lola finally got a prominent credit for some work that they didn't have to hide and pretend they didn't do.
Sure. So before we just get on to that, I just want to hit on one thing that I think really did make the digital heads work, and there's quite a bit published on the emotion capture system that they used to try and get Brad Pitt both the emotional kind of performance stuff that he gave as an actor, but also the physical nature of his face and how that was scanned. But while that's interesting and digitally quite clever, it was not going to ever really give us the eyes, because the eyes are one thing that tend to defeat motion capture or, for that matter, emotion capture systems such as the one that they used. And I did feel many occasions in the early section of the film that a lot of the story was coming, or the performance was coming, from the eyes of the digital head. And had those eyes not conveyed sadness, had those eyes not conveyed wonder, then I don't think we would have gone with the story. And I want to give, you know, points to the animators who must have done a fair amount of manual work on those eyes, because really, you know, especially in an older character like that, where you kind of got big close-ups and they're kind of pondering life and having to kind of extrapolate an emotional kind of intent without a lot of dialogue, that really was, didn't you think the eyes were like really well done?
They were fantastic.
Yeah.
It reminded me of King Kong. What is King Kong? Cause that had fantastic eyes, and there was so much emotion and thought that went in on those eyes. To me, the thing that stood out more than anything else is this is the best digital skin I've ever seen by far. Like that was skin, and you get away with a little bit more because older. So you have a little bit more, you know, paperiness and, powderiness to the skin, but it was such flawless work. And You know, I'm so glad that Digital Domain, which, let's be honest, is a house that a lot of people have forgotten about in recent years. You know, everyone's been talking about Weta and ILM coming back and all that kind of stuff, but Digital Domain has been turning out fantastic work after fantastic work after fantastic work. And, you know, I'm glad that they're finally going to be recognized this year, hopefully, for their work on this film.
I think you're absolutely right, David. Digital Domain had a bad patch a couple of years, maybe 5 years ago, but I think in the last couple of years we've seen that return. But of course, the ironic thing is that for a effects house to rebuild or pull back, it obviously takes a couple of years to show, because they must have been working on this film alone for a couple of years.
Yeah. My hope is that they're going to get awarded a lot more character work out of it. You know, the past couple films that we've seen come out of there have been, for lack of a better word, rigid shows like Stealth and Speed Racer and the like. But, you know, with Mummy 3 and then this, I think they're showing that they're a top-flight character house as well.
Oh, I'm confident that's exactly what's going to happen. I mean, especially as we delve into the way that they pulled this off, it's just... I think the, you know, when we get back to why they deserve the Oscar, you know, the work on this film is going to have an impact for, I think, the rest, you know, the coming decade, potentially.
Mark, do you want to discuss actually how they went about, you know, doing the digital head replacement?
Well, actually, I mean, there's three pieces to it, which were really well delineated in Cinefex did a really nice article, actually, about this movie. And, so there's the animation piece, the rendering piece, and then the actual tracking is, you know, the tracking is the part that a lot of people are paying a lot of attention to. But the other two pieces, I think, I don't know, they used a different paradigm than one that I've seen. And, you know, of the films we've researched for this show, this was the one that made me most sort of, I don't know if I want to say envious, but I would have been very excited to be a compositor on this show, because of how sophisticated the compositing work was, particularly in the rendering portion of those three.
Yeah, no, totally. I couldn't agree with you more. I think absolutely, I had the same sort of envious kind of, wow, these guys have really done amazing work.
Right. So for example, they weren't satisfied to just do spherical environment lighting. That wasn't good enough. So they actually recreated the exact lighting setup from the set and went ahead and tracked and mapped the HDRI data onto their virtual CG set. But then it was actually the compers who were controlling all of the subtle shifts that you would get in lighting as you move around that scene, which you can't get if you've just parked a sphere in the middle of the stage.
And what's interesting about that is that the lighting for the movie was very much what you see is what you get. There wasn't a lot of movie lighting going on in it. It was, if there's a, you know, a lamp that's lighting the scene, well, it's the lamp that's lighting the scene, not a lamp and then like a diffused 2K 100 yards away that's lighting the scene.
Boy, and that's a really good point, because it conjures up why this film feels like it's as gorgeously lit as, you know, Godfather 2, which was another heavily naturally lit film. And I mean, I don't know what you guys thought, but I thought the lighting in this movie was just astonishingly good. You know, they put a pretty heavy color look and a vignette treatment and all kinds, you know, and they played around with film stocks to give the sense of different eras. None of that stuff seemed synthetic or cheesy because of how good the lighting was, I thought.
I thought it was fantastic. I gotta say, I was the one thing that did kind of jar me the first time I saw it was, I was, you know, sitting there watching it and saying, "Oh my God, that's Magic Bullet," but you know, I recognized it kind of instantly. But I think the
can you explain
what
you mean
talking
by that?
Which part?
When they start telling the story about the both the clock in the train station that was built that runs backwards.
And the guy that gets hit by lightning.
And the guy who gets hit by lightning. Oh, both of those, we're using like an old-timey, you know, either a scratch and burn or a black and white, you know, hand crank look. And both of those,
permitted a... If I may take a moment, I would like to read the description from Cinefex of how they did the lightning strike clips. I love this. Okay, check this out. All right. So we printed every single frame of the material on regular paper using a laser printer with really bad toner so that the blacks weren't good and it was all very washed out. Then we macerated the paper, putting it in a jar of coffee so that it became yellowish and worn, and tearing it a little bit frame by frame. In intervals of 10 seconds, we shot that with a digital camera in direct sunlight so we would have a change of lighting and color balance during the day. We also shot it without proper registration so that it looked like it was jittering. Then we applied digital discolorations and cleanups. The final result looked really good. No digital process could have given us the organic feeling of messing with a real material in the real world. Every frame was different.
But they've also said that they used Magic Bullet. So one of those articles is not quite true.
Well, now, mind you, this is just describing the lightning strikes.
Always true.
Okay, maybe they're only referring to the old-timey clock sequences using Magic Bullet. But I
think that's exactly what we are seeing there. Yeah, because there was a distinctive change between the lightning bolt stuff and the old clock,
which were
stuff,
in many ways one of my favorite things about this movie, actually.
The lightning bolt things. Were
I mean,
brilliant.
To me, this movie needed more humor, and man, did those ever just provide nice little bits of just hilarious.
I think Claudia Miranda, who did was the DOP, totally deserves a lot of credit for this film, even though we're going to focus on the visual effects, because here's somebody that's effectively done their first. This is their first full-on, their lead DOP on the film. No, he's been with Fincher in various capacities since 85. And I think his lighting on this film is just magnificent. But I think we can't mention the lighting and the role of the DOP without also pointing out this, in fact, was shot digitally on the Viper camera in film stream mode, shooting effectively DPX files or 1920 by 1080 with a log curve on it.
Well, the Viper is kind of the unsung hero of this movie because it was also the reference camera that Digital Domain used for all the facial capture and for all the reference video for the actors as the body doubles for Brad Pitt all in the beginning of the movie. You know, they used four reference cameras to track everything.
Which I think is another trend that may now become much more of a standard. Don't you guys think? I mean, I could see that just becoming what everybody wants to do now for this type of work.
The multiple camera reference stuff, you mean? Yeah, no, totally. But I do think that...
But with that quality of camera as well.
Sure. But I do think that what's kind of interesting, certainly for me, is Fincher's use of actually going back to Zodiac, because I think Zodiac was an incredibly clean, incredibly good-looking picture. Now, admittedly, I saw that at a private screening, like a pre-screening thing. So it was a good cinema, set up well with really good light and control of the print. But still, it was a digitally captured film, and I've shot with the Viper, and I can tell you that while the Viper's good, there was some serious post-production done on that footage. To get it looking as clean as it was. And I actually went back and found out that they did a complex noise reduction process, cost about $250,000, I think, on Zodiac. And so he's using the Viper again on this film. And Viper isn't the newest of the digital cameras. It's, its CCD is fine and it's terrific and everything, nicely daylight balanced and in many respects good, but it isn't like a particularly new digital camera in comparison to some of the others that have come along since it was released. And yet it does, I think, hold up extremely well on screen.
Well, I think we're starting to see with digital cameras an effect very similar to kind of what happened during when digital first started to come in against film, which is that people want to use what they're comfortable with and not always necessarily be trying out the latest and greatest. You know, we're now getting on to a point where directors are on their second or third movie using digital technology, digital film cameras, and They might not necessarily want to try. Well, I think we all know your camera of choice.
Yeah,
Mike.
I was going to say, Mike. What would you think would be the obvious?
Well,
choice?
No, I mean, I've shot with the Viper, right? I mean, we shot last film we had in Sundance. We shot on the Viper, and happily so. But I mean, we are talking here about effectively an HD 444 camera, right? I mean, this is not a 4K camera. This is not even a 2K camera. This is an HD camera, effectively. And you wouldn't have looked at this footage and said, well, that's shot HD. I mean, obviously, it's more complicated than that because it uses the logarithmic encoding method with the film stream mode. But still, it is effectively an HD camera.
So you were looking for clipping and what else?
Yeah, and just generally the optical quality of the footage didn't suffer, in my opinion.
No.
Obviously, in the hands of a really good DOP, but this was not a film that, you know, I think that it benefited from digital because I think some of the things you guys referred to, the use of natural light and stuff, low light performance is something that you tend to get better out of a digital camera. But I just, you know, didn't feel electronic. This felt a lot less electronic, for example, than, say, Get Smart, which was shot with the Genesis camera, which was released after the Viper and also had a very good DOP, but for me, you know, looked more electronic in the scenes, where this didn't ever feel electronic to me. Did anything for you, David, for example, look electronic?
No, not at all. And I know what you're talking about. You know, the two comments I want to make on this is, you know, I think you've kind of gone on the record and saying that Build 16 with the Red was like the first real release of the Red, and you know, this movie was well into post production by the time that came out. But I just recently saw a film called 21, which, with Kevin Spacey in it, mm-hmm. the with quite an accomplished DP whose name escapes me at this moment, but, you know, he was a DP on True Lies and many, many other fine films, yet the movie looks like it was shot on home video, because of how the camera was handled. And I think this movie proves it's not about the equipment, and people need to get that out of their head. This, you know, the Viper is also a 2/3-inch chip camera, and this film, you know, in terms of depth of field and you know, that meaty filmic look, goes toe to toe with anything short of maybe, you know, an IMAX, you know, or CinemaScope anamorphic film in terms of just its meatiness, for lack of a better word. You know, there's no way I would, if you had not told me that this was digital, there's no way I would have said it was digital.
I mean, I know what you're saying about 21. I didn't like 21 as much as I liked the book, Breaking the House, but I think Russell Carpenter, who was the DOP on 21, you know, wasn't that bad. But I definitely think that that what we saw on this film was just outstanding. And really, any reason to not use or to use digital, I think you're absolutely right. Like, we've crossed the line now. If you want to use digital, that's fine. If you've got a good DOP who knows what they're doing, then they can get outstanding results, and it's not going to be limited by, you know, stuff to do. I mean, there are some advantages. I was talking to a very famous DOP at a function here in Sydney, and I was asking him about digital, and I expected him to come back with a technical answer. He had looked at it for shooting some big, big, big Hollywood features, and he said, well, I like digital because it means we don't have to interrupt the actors by changing the mag. So there's a lot of reasons why, you know, digital has stuff away from technical stuff, and I think that's what we should be thinking about, is this the artistic merit of it, because it just isn't technical.
Well, it plays into a lot of things. I mean, Fincher talked about the fact that he got away from doing dailies and went to doing hourlies on this film. And it's something you're seeing actually more and more, is that you will have an editor working live on set as stuff is coming in, literally cutting it in and seeing how it's working, you know, as is, right then. What do you need? What's working? What's not? What do we need to get before we, you know, break for the day, or before we strike the set, or what have you? And that's really where digital is starting to change. It is not only in how it affects post, but how it affects the actual filmmaking process itself.
Well, one of the things that I was interested in is a comment Fincher made about the fact that he could actually work with a smaller crew, because he finds filmmaking just a series of compromises. And by reducing the size of his film crew, in fact, he could sometimes shoot with as little as a five-person crew on a camera. he was basically reducing the amount of compromises he had to make because it wasn't, you know, a huge amount of stuff. And I had not occurred to me that that would be an advantage for him, just to be able to work with a smaller, lighter crew. But definitely, I think to get these kind of performances, yes, there would have been some scenes that were incredibly technically laborious to kind of like, you know, make sure everything lined up and that foreground plates were matching backgrounds. But there's a lot of it that you would have wanted to let people just, you know, work with the material and act. I mean, I think we haven't mentioned Cate Blanchett yet. And certainly, Mark, I'd be interested in your opinion. I mean, I can't say anything bad against Cate because, you know, she's our Cate and we love her. But what did you think of her in this film?
Oh, she was great. She looked beautiful. She was a, you know, powerful counterpart. Actually, a more, you know, a character you could get more involved with, really. She had a whole character arc of her own. I guess they had a technical problem with her because her skin is so smooth and perfect that the things they had to do to kind of, you know, the Lola de-aging process, they had to actually add some stuff back onto her face to just hide it because, if I read that correctly or understood it correctly, that's what I heard happened there.
I mean, I definitely was heading that direction because I think some of the work done, I mentioned at the beginning of the show that there was some various, you know, components we could talk about. We've spoken quite a lot about that 52 minutes of digital head. But for me, the work of Lola, in particular in Cate Blanchett's character's case, was pretty fascinating. And I'll draw your attention, for example, to Cate's inability to actually be a world-class ballerina, and her rather good performance as a ballerina in this, as a, you know, great case of digital effects really serving the story. I thought the digital head, which I think was done in Mental Images, that was tracked on, or the digital face that was tracked onto the body of the ballerina, was just superb work. And I mean, David, did you find any of that to be of merit?
I thought it was fantastic. It's amazing how quickly things have advanced since X-Men 3 in their youngifying process, or whatever their probably proprietary term for it is. The one that I think was really noticeable is, Cate Blanchett was perfect, but the woman is a chameleon. I mean, she is, I think, just an amazing, amazing actor. So is Tilda Swinton. But the young Brad Pitt, when he's, you know, comes back to the dance studio and he's in shadowed, and then he steps into the light and it's pretty much Brad Pitt from Thelma and Louise. The first audience I saw it with was a Hollywood advanced screening, and there was a loud, audible gasp in the audience that they were stunned by it because, you know, that's the Brad Pitt that made Brad Pitt into Brad Pitt. And it was, you know, they've gotten it down to a science. And you could almost afterwards, talking with people, see the wheels turning in people's heads in terms of what this is going to let people do is extend their careers. Because you're going to have, to be brutally honest, to be really awful as a, you know, just Hollywood douchebag, you know, if you're a woman in this town, unless you are an unbelievably fantastic actress, you have a shelf life of maybe 10 years. And this technology lets the people who are really good actresses, maybe not the great ones, not just the great ones, but, you know, just good actresses, have a little bit more life in their career because of what you can do to, you know, take away those things that are so objectionable, you know, like life and experience and some kind of aging on your face, which I don't think is at all objectionable, but that will, so you'll have people who have the acting chops to actually do something and emote and portray a character, and then we could take care of the wrinkles afterwards. And I think it's a good thing.
Yeah, I mean, it's not cheap. Like, let's be really blunt, technologically speaking. Like, it isn't that some of the aging stuff that, say, a company like Lola has done is a clever new button that RenderMan gave to the world in 3D, or is it something that Autodesk published as a new upgrade to a Flame or something? This is incredibly painstaking, very precise, just, you know,
artistry,
fingers bleeding kind of work.
It's artistry, but
yeah,
but
so what, so you'd want to be fairly well paid actress.
You want
to afford to be
exactly, but you know, the way you look at it is, no matter what the cost, you know, what costs more, paying somebody to remove some wrinkles from your actress's face, or having a movie that doesn't make nearly as much money because the hot young ingenue you have playing the lead role sucks and no one wants to go see your movie.
Yeah, well, I'd agree. I mean, I personally think Kate Blanchett is the Catherine Hepburn of our generation, and I wish she hadn't starred as Catherine Hepburn already, because then that would be a much more insightful comment. And personally, I'm not really into kind of blondy, young, kind of stupid-looking, not very intelligent actresses. So I don't mind an actress. I think I've already said that Emma Thompson is my idea of a dream woman. But having said that, I do accept the fact that a lot of people want to do that. But let's also admit that a lot of people already do that. That a lot of people, the reason that Lola has been so successful is, you know, they've made a lot of money doing stuff they'll never talk about to a lot of actors that we all know but can't talk about. That this isn't, that you're suggesting perhaps that this is going to happen. I'm saying that it's already happening.
Well, no, I'm saying that it has already happened, and something that, you know, visual effects people have known has been happening, and some people knew it was possible. What I'm saying is this was like a big coming out party for it, I think. In, you know, when they did it in X-Men, it was effective, but it still looked a little bit wonky. In this, I think like 99% of that wonkiness was gone. And I think a lot of people were seeing that you could have a really, really dramatic effect, and it would still be realistic. And if you can do that dramatic an effect and have it be realistic, what if you know, didn't need to take 20 years off? What could you do then? And I think it was... I could literally, you could almost taste it in the air after the screening. People, like, that was the thing that people were talking about more than anything else, in terms of the effects of the movie, is how good young Brad looked.
Yeah, I mean, I think, as I said, there are three things. If that's the second one, which I agree with you, is just almost as completely, you know, valid a reason for a nomination for Oscars as the digital head replacement. I think the third one that almost doesn't get discussed in this film is that this was a period film, right? There was a lot of green screen, a lot of matte paintings, and a lot of just general visual effects that, of course, normally would get a good mention, but in light of the first two points, aren't getting much of a look in. And I guess I was going to throw to you, Mark, if you could give us some comments on your thoughts on, for example, the sub attack and some of the period stuff that we saw throughout Eastern Europe and the matte painting work in when he starts traveling and leaving his New Orleans base.
Well, I mean, I said before that as a compositor, I would love, you know, more than any film we've discussed to have worked on this one. But boy, I got to say, if you're a matte painter, David Fincher is your guy that you want to work for, because your work is going to not disappear in 5 seconds. It held down the whole first section of the movie. All of the recreation of the environment of New Orleans, you know, which was grand and very showy. They're celebrating Armistice. Big deal. It was cool. And then, I mean, the World War II battle, you know, gorgeous, epic. Some things I had not seen before that they were doing actually to be more realistic. I mean, stepping away from the look of the matte paintings and the skies and so on for a second, the actual combat and the you know, for example, the tracer fire, it was so kinetic and, you know, pretty startling. And I guess, I don't know, I haven't been in a gunfight like that, but apparently they were being more true to how it is than some other films that they had looked at.
Yeah, I mean, I think the whole sub scene, there was a little bit when it first went to sea with the sub that had a look of, it reminded me of the film Troy, perhaps because it was another Brad Pitt film. Not that that's a bad thing, but it was, you know, slightly too picturesque, slightly mm-hmm. too stylized for my taste. I think New Orleans was terrific. But once it got to the sub scene, I thought that was really well done. I thought it was a good balance between able to, because I think in reality, it would have been so pitch black, you'd have been hard pushed to see bloody anything, right?
Well, I'm sure you were aware that that boat was on a gimbal at some times, but were you ever really thinking about it? Because I can't say that I particularly was.
No.
I think it was maybe a little overlit, but that's what you have to do in film to just see what the hell's going on. But I didn't. Yeah. What were you going to say, David?
Well, I just find it amusing the fact that, you know, the work for the digital water and, you know, the whole digital environment that was created for that whole sequence was, you know, 10 years ago, Titanic won an Oscar for it. And then Perfect Storm did something, you know, pretty similar, and it was still groundbreaking. And now it's kind of like, oh yeah, we're going to do a complete, you know, digital creation of an ocean with splashes and an explosion in the water, and it's all going to be done digitally, and we've done it before, so we're not even going to, like, that's not even really talked about in the visual effects meat of the, you know, that would have been a whole project.
But not on this show, David. On this show, we give them their piece because we know how hard it was to get there.
Yeah, well, we're giving them their piece, but we're giving them their piece, you know, 4/5 of the way into the show is what I'm saying. When 10 years ago, that would have been like, that would have been a show all unto itself. Like, I mean, meaning a movie all unto itself to have that number of digital water effects and that complexity. I must
say, by the way, we're talking about Asylum here. Predominantly with the water effects.
Yes.
Who did a lot of Master and Commander and a really good job at it. I mean, I go back to Zodiac, right? There was some matte painting work done in Zodiac and a bunch of shots above cars on the streets at night that I was, you know, completely unaware was digital set extension and digital reconstruction. And
you got to come to San Francisco more often.
I like San Francisco.
It looked different.
As you know.
Well, you have to remember that David Fincher got his start photographing matte paintings. That was his start in the industry as a visual effects shooter. So,
Return of the Jedi, for example.
Yeah, so he has a love of matte painting as an art, I believe. And, you know, he went to the experts at Matte World Digital, who I think are the best matte painters in the industry.
So was there, leaving aside the aging, leaving aside the digital character, and just focusing on this third section as we're closing the show out, was there anything that we've failed to signal that you think really worked well? I mean, I think the clock environment where that clock was, that was pretty much all a digital set, and I thought that looked very nice. It, you know, nice sort of atmosphere, light coming through the windows kind of stuff. It reminded me of a Grand Central Station kind of feel. Was there anything else that you liked in that realm of the non-aging stuff?
The one thing I thought it was cute, but it was like in the back of my head, I'm like, oh my God, that's so incredibly easy, was the falling buttons with the camera projected texture of the Paramount logo at the beginning of the movie.
It's funny you mentioned that. I like that as well.
I was like cute, and I was just like, oh my God, we're going to see that so much now. Like the idea of just taking a camera projection and some kind of animation or simulation,
I thought it was nice.
This movie to me was perfection from start to finish. And then later on, I have a follow up comment related to that. But Mark, I'll let you get
and,
your comments.
And you, Mark,
You're asking if there's anything we have not called out.
Well, I think in this third area, in this area that wasn't the aging, that you think we should highlight.
My sympathies go out to the company that did the Katrina hurricane outside the hospital, because apparently they had no idea what they were being asked to do, and like they said, they modeled the insides of cars and things, so I don't think that a lot of it got used. But and I I actually, where I really feel bad for them is I really didn't like that they pasted Katrina on this. I guess they felt like since they said it in New Orleans in some recent era, they had to deal with that behemoth. But to me, it was one more thing that just didn't add up for me as making any difference to the story. And
I thought it was going to play much more prominently. I thought that it was going to be a you know, oh, I get it kind of moment, and it kind of petered away to being nothing more than a sort of a side aspect.
Yeah, it drowned the clock or something. I don't know.
I have a feeling that that might have been covered in the hour and 25 minutes that they cut out of the film in order to get down to 2 hours and 47 minutes. they might have covered that a little bit more. You know,
well, we'll find out.
We'll find out inevitably on the special edition. We're gonna give.
You're talking to a guy who just bought the 5-disc Ultimate Blade Runner box set, including notes. So yes, I'm definitely gonna buy that when it comes out. That'd be fun. David, you alluded to earlier that you're gonna discuss one other point you wanted to come back to. Can we get that before we finish?
Yeah. You know, this is, I think, a fantastic, fantastic film, and I think it has fantastic visual effects. And there's a couple other visual effects films that have come out, but I think our audience tends to be people who love visual effects and also love film. And there's a couple movies out that have absolutely no obvious visual effects, but I want to encourage people to go see them because they might not necessarily see them in the theater, and I think they deserve to be seen. So I just want to encourage people to go see, in no particular order, Frost Nixon.
Oh, very good film.
Milk and The Wrestler. These are all films that I think are just fantastic, fantastic examples of filmmaking.
Well, being a Rumblefish fan from way back, the third film is an easy one for me. Milk, I'm intrigued. I've just got the American cinematographer that has that on the cover. I have not seen that, but that's set up in San Francisco where you are, isn't it, Mark?
Yeah, and actually I saw it at the Castro Theater, which is half a block up the street from Harvey Milk's old camera shop.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's. I think there's a tendency for... I remember when I was a wee lad, and this gets kind of into the theme of Benjamin Button. I wasted a lot of my time going to movies that just had things exploding and digital creatures ripping people apart. And there's so much more to movies than just that. And that I just encourage people to go and see film. You know, I get a little bit sick and tired of people saying, you know, they don't make movies like they used to. And then they point out, you know, they would never make Casablanca or Citizen Kane or Maltese Falcon these days. And they also made really, really, really crappy movies in 1939. It's just that we haven't bothered to remember them. And I think in 20 years, people are going to remember Benjamin Button and Milk and Slumdog Millionaire. And they're going to forget about Epic Movie and Disaster Film and what have you. And as much as we might love them, I don't think in 40 years people are still going to be watching Iron Man or Pirates of the Caribbean and other fantastic films of the visual effects genre. So I just want to encourage people to see movies outside of your normal viewing habits that might be just fantastic movies.
Well, good. And I do think this is a great film to start the year off because, you know, it really is a terrific, terrific film. If you haven't seen it yet, obviously we hope that you do. Most people like to listen to these shows once they've seen the films. We know that. So we try and give it a week or two before we come out with the show. I think we've pretty much covered this film, which is great, and I'm glad that we've done it. I'm so glad to have you guys back on the show. We've missed you. You've not been here mainly, I think, just because of scheduling issues. But it's nice to have you back.
Yes,
yeah, it's great.
Work's been
back.
Keeping me busy. It's been good to be back.
Yeah. Obviously, people are keen to know how they can touch base and see what you're up to. So, starting with you, Mark.
I'm most regularly findable these days on Twitter as Flow Seeker. And I do have, I don't have a soapbox prepared like David had, but I do have a new edition of my book, which is all about doing visual effects in many people's last choice for visual effects compositing, After Effects. But it's also one that you can do a lot with if you're willing.
And I certainly follow Flowseeker. It's great to see what you're up to. In fact, I actually, now you mention it, remember when you went and saw Milk.
Yeah.
And David, you're also on Twitter and elsewhere.
I am on the Twitter. As David Strapanis, all one word. You can reach me at david@vfxshow.com. And you can also check out my blog, www.davidstrapanis.com. And if you... on Twitter, if you at me or DM me, or you email me, especially if you email me, include your Twitter ID so I can message you that way, and I'll try to get back to you with any questions you might have or comments, for good or for ill. Always love to hear from people who are listening.
So before we go to what's coming up in future episodes, Mark, if you want to thank our terrific producers and researchers.
Yes, absolutely. And we want to thank Kristen Martin, who got me back up on my feet with Soundtrack Pro this week. So if I sound good, thank you to Kristen for that, as well as for facilitating us doing this. And Lori Apthorpe, providing the research along with the team from Pixel Core.
Yeah, Lori does great research. We appreciate her for doing that. People behind the scenes are always so vital. So coming up in future weeks, I can say we're going to have you back, I believe, next week, David, for Day the Earth Stood Still.
That is the plan, yes.
Joined by John, who's been emailing me while we've been talking, with a huge array of expletives, basically, that summarized down to, oops, I missed the show. And then I believe that, Mark, you'll be joining us for The Spirit in a few weeks' time.
Yes, look forward to that.
And we've also got Valkyrie coming up, which I'm looking forward to, some old films like Fifth Element and a film, and some TV shows, actually. We're doing Pushing Daisies, a show I do not get, but apparently I'm meant to. Anyway, this has been a joint production of Pixel Core and FXGuide.com. Thank you so much for listening, guys. Talk to you next time. Goodbye.